I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Why did the chicken cross the road? Was it perhaps to confuse and bewilder and disrupt the proper functioning of an autonomous vehicle with all of its nifty sensors and computers? You think I'm joking. I'm really not. Apparently, an autonomous or driverless car, not long ago, mistook a man in a chicken suit crossing the road. This high-tech car was supposed to be able to process enough data to not make mistakes. There's enough driver error with us humans to be introducing driverless error to our streets and highways, but the car did in fact mistake the costumed man, not for a chicken perhaps, but at least was unable to say to itself, "Watch out, pedestrian ahead." These kinds of stories describing the long and rarely straight road that is the history of our devices of transport make for very good reading in the book by Tom Standage titled A Brief History of Motion, From the Wheel to the Car to What Comes Next. Standage is deputy editor of The Economist and a return guest to Constant Wonder. Tom, thanks for joining with us once again.
It's great to be here again.
Tom, I don't think that we're going to stop at every way station from the wheel to the future, but I want to drop it in at some, you know, colorful places along the way. And
sure.
So it's kind of a grab bag here. But what about this chicken guy? Did that really happen?
Yeah, it did. No, so that story was told to me by the CEO of one of the autonomous car makers. I can't remember which one it was. I think it was Carl Yadnema told me that story. But he was telling me about essentially the difficulty of training these cars to recognize what's happening. And you think you've thought of everything, and then you're driving down the street and you're looking at, you know, what the car thinks the world looks like, and it draws maybe blue boxes around cars and red boxes around cyclists and green boxes around pedestrians. And then you see a guy standing on a corner with a chicken suit holding up a sign saying, you know, chicken lunches, you know, a special offer today, and it doesn't draw the pedestrian box around him, and you realize that that's the problem. And this is a very long-standing problem with autonomous cars, that you think that the world is always stranger than they expect it to be. Another pioneer of autonomous cars, Sebastian Thrun, told me that when they first built the original Google driverless cars, and one of them saw a paper bag blowing across a freeway and thought that it was a flying child. And that was what it categorized as. Another big problem was if you have bicycles mounted on the back of a car, the autonomous car may think those are bicycles that are sort of flying through the air and happen to be behind the car. So it then tries to predict which direction they're going to go in. So there are all of these difficult situations where, you know, we as humans with common sense would not be fooled, but the driverless cars are being fooled. And this can have tragic consequences, of course. There was the woman who died a few years ago, was struck by an autonomous car in Arizona. And this was, she was wheeling her bicycle across the freeway at night. And, you know, the car didn't expect to see a bicycle going at 90 degrees to the direction of traffic. And maybe it had been programmed to ignore bicycles facing that way because it thinks they're stuck on the back of cars. But it had this exact problem. It couldn't classify what this was. And so it didn't raise the alarm and it didn't stop. And she was killed. So, you know, there are funny stories about chickens, but, you know, there are serious consequences. But there's also another story about a chicken earlier in automotive history, which is when the first cars go on the road. Motorists were really, you know, very unpopular. They're driving through the countryside, they're making these clouds of dust and all this terrible noise. And farmers in particular disliked them because they would run over their chickens. And the motorists at the time complained that the farmers were deliberately breeding chickens and training them to run in front of cars so that they could then complain and demand financial compensation. So anyway, chickens and cars, there seems to be a long-standing relationship antagonism.
The reason I want to ask you about these stories, it seems like your project in this book is to talk about the perennial problems that come about when we try to marry who we are with the devices that we've contrived for our transportation, that whatever it's going to be, from a chariot to an AV, an autonomous vehicle, we have to somehow appropriate or accommodate the new technology in our culture, and that doesn't happen easy.
Yes, and it always has unexpected consequences. And this is the theme that runs through all of my books. This is my seventh, but they're all about the history of technology in different ways. And they have the running gag, as it were, that technologies come and go, and they push the same old buttons in our Stone Age brains. So human nature doesn't change, and the way that people react to things has not really changed over the past few millennia. And so that's why I can look in books at, how the Romans felt about social media, or how the Victorians felt about online dating, or, how Egyptian warriors felt about chariots. The idea that you are what you drive, and the coolest people should have the coolest and the fastest cars, is a very ancient idea. And it goes back to the invention of the chariot, actually by the Hittites, but then it's adopted by the Egyptians as well. And so that whole idea that, your vehicle is a form of self-expression is an incredibly ancient idea. And another example is in the 1670s, Samuel Pepys, the London diarist, who, famously wrote this diary. Actually, it was during the 1660s, wasn't it? Not the 1670s. But he gets his own carriage. He becomes wealthy enough to afford his own carriage. And he goes to the theatre with his wife, mainly so that everyone can see that he is now wealthy enough to afford a carriage. And, anyone who's ever enjoyed the smell of a new car, that new car smell, can relate to what Samuel Pepys is saying, all of those years ago.
Yeah. Well, so how did Egyptian warriors feel about chariots? Did they welcome them?
Well, originally, the Egyptians were not very impressed by wheels. So the wheel is invented around 3500 BC. We're not sure where, but it looks like the evidence is that it was actually in Eastern Europe, Central Europe, not in Mesopotamia, which it was long assumed it was, because the Mesopotamians invented so many other things like beer and writing and cities. They're pretty awesome. But it looks like they borrowed the idea of the wheel. And the Egyptians next door borrowed some ideas from the Mesopotamians, probably writing, but they managed to build the pyramids without using wheels at all. And they, in fact, didn't really adopt them for a couple of thousand years. And this is because the easiest way to move stuff around in Egypt was to use the River Nile and just float things on rafts and move things up and down the Nile that way. So they built the pyramids with rafts and with rollers to move things on land. And in fact, no wheeled wagon of the time could possibly have, taken those enormous blocks they used to build the pyramids anyway. So they're really not that impressed by wheels. And the idea that wheels were sort of immediately seized upon as the greatest invention ever is a very modern idea. It's only in the early 20th century, when the world has been reshaped by wheeled vehicles, that, that the idea that the wheel is the greatest invention of all time becomes more widespread. So for the Egyptians, they are pretty much ignoring wheels. And then it's about sort of 1600 BC, I think, that the Hittites come up with these war chariots, which are small, light, two-wheeled vehicles that can go extremely fast. And they become extremely powerful militarily. They conquer a big chunk of the ancient Near East. And the Egyptians have to respond, so they start building chariots too, and they have this big chariot battle against the Hittites, the Battle of Kadesh. And so at that point, you start to get the depictions of kings as these heroic warriors in chariots. And there are lots of examples of this in Egypt. Tutankhamun is buried with these amazingly small, light chariots. They weigh about 35 kilos, so about half as much as I do. So you could lift one up, but they were these incredible vehicles. They were sort of the Ferraris of their day. And so this idea that the gods must also ride chariots, because the gods must be like the most awesome people, also becomes quite widespread. So Assyrian wall reliefs, as well as Egyptians, depict the gods and the kings out about and about on their chariots and hunting and smiting their enemies and so on. And they're sort of, that whole period, the sort of swords and sandals and the biblical battles and so on, we imagine chariots. But chariots actually then became obsolete about 1,000 years later. By the time of Alexander the Great, horses had been bred to be big enough to take armed and armored warriors. And a horse is a lot more versatile than a chariot. You can ride it up a hill and over bumpy ground. And so Alexander the Great defeats the Persians at the Battle of Gaugamela, and he absolutely routs them. And there's a famous depiction of this where Alexander is shown on his horse triumphant, and the Persian king is fleeing in shame in his chariot. And this is because the chariot has become obsolete. And so then, in fact, you get this reversal where real men ride horses, and we get this actually continues for quite a while, into the Middle Ages, the idea that a man isn't a man unless he's on a horse goes through to that period, and the idea of chivalrous knights and so on. And wheeled vehicles are for women. And the idea of the kind of the princess in the carriage And, you know, when you see the princess in her carriage, the knight that she's fallen in love with is always on horseback, right? He's always riding. He's not actually in the carriage. And this was the idea that, you know, persisted into the Middle Ages, that horses were noble and manly, and that it was actually demeaning for a man, or certainly a noble man, to be seen in a wheeled vehicle. So there's a lot of bumps in the road, you might say, to the point where we get to, you know, cars and you are what you drive and so on. But there are these sort of commonalities that we see across the centuries.
Now that you've mentioned carriages, I'm so tempted to ask you about coaches. We're going to go there in just a second. But first, I guess what I hear you saying is that humans are sluggish adopters of new tech.
Some of the time they are, and some of the time they aren't. I mean, there are always some people who will jump on the newest thing. And this has always been the case. You know people like that today. They've got to have the latest iPhone. They've got to have the latest car, whatever. And there are also other people who are quite willing to sort of let other people go to the bleeding edge, see how it works out and see what happens. And so we've seen that with all sorts of technologies. And, you know, I've written about many of these technologies, that you always get people use technologies to connect with members of the opposite sex. You always get people using new technologies for crime, you know, and the car is no different. It transforms dating. It's used as getaway vehicles. It's that the telegraph was the same in the 19th century. You get online dating chat rooms, and then you also get cybercrime. And so we tend to blame the technology for these human failings. And in fact, what technology does is it just amplifies existing human nature. And so that makes, you know, some people better and some people worse, and some aspects of good behavior more prominent and some aspects of bad behavior more prominent. So I think that's true of all technologies.
Well, at some point, does there not have to be sort of a sea change in collective thinking about a technology? I'm thinking, for example, about urban design. You know, it's all good and fine to bring chariots around or come with carriages or even the automobile. But if you don't have streets for them, and if your cities don't provide for that, you got a problem.
No, exactly. And so we do see this, that obviously a lot of medieval cities in Europe, but even older cities. So my favorite example is Pompeii, the Roman town that was preserved by the eruption of Vesuvius. And what you see there is a town that was originally founded in the 6th century BC when wheeled vehicles were not very commonplace. And so it's got very narrow streets. And by the time it becomes a popular resort town in the Roman period, you've got lots of wealthy Romans who want to go there, and they're all sort of doing up their houses, and, you know, they want to be able to move stuff through the streets, and they've got this real problem. And so what they end up doing in Pompeii is introducing a one-way system, and it's very, very similar to the one in Manhattan, where alternating streets go in opposite directions. And this allows them to have more wheeled vehicles in the town. They also introduce a sort of bypass, and then they pedestrianize some areas of the city as well, because they recognize that you don't want to mix people and vehicles all the time. And then later Roman cities are actually built with grid systems and wide enough streets that they can cope with two lanes of traffic, arcades for the pedestrians. So they're actually segregating the road traffic from the pedestrians. And so, yes, you do start to get the impact of vehicles on urban design spreading through. And, you know, and then ultimately you get the sort of 20th century expression of this in the form of the commuter suburb, where you have, you know, every house has a garage for the car, and, you know, the only way in and out is by car, and so on and so on. But this sort of long-term impact of vehicles and transport technology on urban design, you know, goes back all of that way, you know, goes back thousands of years.
Tom Standage is with us. He's author of A Brief History of Motion, From the Wheel to the Car and to What Comes Next. And we're going to follow up on that question about what is a coach anyway? Where does the word even come from? We'll ask him after a short break here on our show. I'm Marcus Smith. Stay tuned for more Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. You're listening to Constant Wonder. Thanks for joining with us. Tom Standage is with us. He's got a new book out titled A Brief History of Motion, From the Wheel to the Car to What Comes Next. And that word coach, Tom, just before the break, I was musing upon that. I've used it all my life, it seems, and I don't even know why we call a coach a coach.
Well, a coach, as far as we can tell, it's named after a Hungarian village called Coach. It's on a main road that runs through Hungary in the mid-15th century, and it seems to be where a new kind of carriage emerged. It was certainly what that carriage was named after. And so they became known as coaches. And what's interesting about them is that they seem to be much lighter and much faster coaches. But the really striking thing about them is that they became cool. And I was saying earlier that men up until this point in the medieval period were, you know, they were meant to be noble knights on horseback, and you know, it was manly to ride a horse, but it was not manly to ride in a wheeled vehicle. That was for women and for servants. And yet the coach becomes fashionable, and men decide that actually riding coaches, preferably as fast as possible, is a cool thing to do. And what seems to have happened is this seems to have coincided with the invention of gunpowder weapons. And essentially, these sort of small cannons or large guns, I mean, they're sort of in between the two, they're first examples. They're very dangerous if you're a knight on horseback. And suddenly the knight on horseback looks very, very old fashioned and looks obsolete. And the people who have mounted these guns on the side of wagons, suddenly they are the people with the military upper hand. And so by extension, those wheeled vehicles are suddenly much more cool and cutting edge. And so the fastest, coolest versions of them are the coach. And so the coach spreads incredibly quickly across Europe. And this sort of idea that it's manly to be able to drive a coach at high speed becomes, you know, that spreads too. And so we're back to where we were with chariots, which is that, you know, it is manly to drive really fast in a wheeled vehicle. And that really had gone out of fashion for a couple of thousand years there, but it came back with a vengeance, and it's been back with us ever since.
So now I'm thinking about the phrase form follows function, but really maybe fashion follows military needs is what's going on here, that it becomes socially not just acceptable, but admirable to do the thing that was devised for military purposes.
Well, we're not sure. I mean, I think people who saw coaches in other parts of the world might not have known about this idea of the military fort, but they saw the dashing people driving around in their coaches and thought that's pretty cool. Not everyone was you know, up for this, though. There were concerns in some countries, in some parts of Germany, for example, there were concerns that if young men basically took up coaching instead of riding, then in the event of a war, they wouldn't be able to compete properly as horseback warriors, and that this was sort of leading to the loss of valuable military skills. But people just thought that riding coaches really fast was really cool, and these coaches had, you know, decent suspension and big wheels, and you could, you know, you'd have two or four horses, and they could really go very quickly. So I think it's more that sort of speed was fashionable, and this was a sort of more comfortable way of going really fast and impressing people than just riding on a horse.
Well, I want you to share with us a few strands of the story of how the automobile was accommodated in our societies and how it became normalized.
Where do you want to start?
Shall we start with Bertha Benz?
I think Bertha Benz is a brilliant place to start. Yes, absolutely. So the first road trip, it's 1888, and Bertha Benz, her husband, Carl Benz, is one of the people building a prototype. Various people are trying to build these prototype, what we now call automobiles. But essentially, they're taking engines of various kinds and fixing them onto wheeled vehicles. And, you know, people have been trying to do this for at least 100 years. The problem is that the engines available at the time are these big, heavy steam engines, and they're very, very big and very slow. It takes a long time to get them started and so on. And a new kind of engine has just been invented, the internal combustion engine. And so it's initially used in factories to drive machinery, but people look at it and go, well, that's much smaller and neater than a steam engine. You could put that in a carriage. And so they start experimenting. And Benz, in fact, builds this vehicle called the Motorwagen. He mostly builds it out of bicycle parts. So it's got spoked wheels. It's a tricycle. The front wheel is steered using a tiller, and it has a sort of bench across the back. And then it has an internal combustion engine under the seat. So this is the first modern car. It's been custom built around the engine. And he builds it, and he tests it in the yard of his house in Germany with his wife, Bertha, and they sort of drive it around the yard. And then he sort of goes and makes improvements to it. And he's been working on this for a couple of years. And she started to get impatient that he's never going to actually go out and try and sell it, that he's going to be tinkering with it forever. So she tries to convince him that it is actually ready for prime time. And the way she does it is one morning she takes this prototype car, and she gets her two teenage sons out of bed, and they all get in this car, and she drives to her mother's house, which is 65 miles away. So this is the first time anyone has made a long, you know, journey on public roads in a car. And now you may ask yourself, how does she fill the car up? Because there's no filling stations. Well, it turns out that gasoline, which had a different name in Germany at the time, but it was sold in pharmacies as a cleaning fluid. So she could stop at pharmacies occasionally and pour fuel into the car. She could also top up the water because there were troughs next to the next to the roads that were used by horses. Now, she did have a few problems on the way. One of the reasons she took the boys was that the lowest gear on the car was quite weak and it really couldn't go up steep hills. And there were a couple of hills on the route, so she had to get the boys to get out and push. She also had a few other incidents. She had to unblock the fuel line with a hat pin at one point, and she had to also deal with a short circuit in the ignition, which she is said to have fixed using one of her garters. And she gets to her mother's house in the evening, and she sends a telegram to her husband saying, "By the way, I've taken the car and gone to see my mother." And a few days later, she drives back again. And on the way back, she comes up with some further innovations. Going down the hills that they've pushed their way up, the car brakes really aren't very good. And so she stops at a cobbler's and has him add leather to the brake pads so that they can grip the wheels more effectively. So she gets back home and she says to her husband, "This is great. I went on a road trip. You need to fix the low gear so that we can get up steeper hills. And you also need to fix the brake pads." And he says, "Great." And he does. And this gives him the confidence that he needs to take the car out into the world and say, "Look, I've invented this thing." And he shows it at a sort of, you know, exposition a few weeks later. And it's the star of the show. He's in all the papers. He wins prizes. And, you know, that's the beginning of the commercialization of the automobile. So we have Bertha Benz to thank for that original road trip. And you know, when we go on a road trip, and funnily enough, I'm going on one later tonight to see my mother. And I will be thinking of Bertha Benz as I, you know, put my foot down on the gas.
Yeah, and in the Bertha Benz story, we have no idea, do we, how Granny was faring?
No, we don't know. I mean, we don't know what the you know, proximate cause was. I think it was just that, you know, when you live 65 miles away from people in the old days, going to see people was quite an undertaking. But if you've got the option to use this vehicle that you just have to pour fuel into occasionally, then surely that's much more convenient. And so, you know, we all know this is the great thing, the great trade, the great deal we've made with the car. It has all of these drawbacks that we know about, but at the end of the day, it does grant you this freedom, in theory at least, to go where you want, when you want.
Would you tell us a little bit about the difficulty of introducing automobiles to society? I mean, they were hazardous things. You've already talked about chickens on the road, but there were more than just chickens, and there certainly weren't plastic bags yet, but there were children and a lot of child deaths.
Yes, no, absolutely. So initially, when cars were first being promoted, as they were being promoted as a solution to the horse manure problem. So horses were the, you know, horse-drawn transport was a big problem because horses produce all this pollution in the form of horse manure. There was terrible traffic in the fast-growing cities of the industrializing, you know, West. So New York and London in particular had terrible traffic problems. There was a lot of noise, and there were accidents with horses because they could run away, they could get scared, they could kick people. And so initially, proponents of cars are saying, well, this is going to fix all our problems because we're going to have no horse manure. We're not going to have any traffic jams anymore because cars take up less space than a horse and a carriage. A horseless carriage, as it was called at the time, you know, only needs half the amount of space. So there'll be more room on the street, and that will get rid of the traffic jams. They'll be much quieter because they've got rubber tires, so there won't be any more noise. And they'll be much safer because you can scare a horse, but you can't scare a car. And of course, all of those things turned out to be wrong. You can't see the pollution that cars produce, but it is just as dangerous, both the particulates to our lungs and the CO2 to the planet. And of course, you know, we still have traffic jams. In fact, we have even worse traffic jams. And we, you know, cars are noisy and people honk their horns. And we have a lot more accidents because cars could go very quickly. And, you know, people would step into the road and they wouldn't expect something going that fast to hit them. And so, yes, there was this big problem in the 1920s in particular that cars were demonized as these kind of child killing machines, which they were. And the auto industry responded by essentially fighting this very effective PR campaign that has changed the way we look at the world. We look at a road now and we think it's a place that naturally belongs to cars. And if you stand in the middle of it, you're asking to be killed. And that's a very recent idea. That's a 100-year-old idea that has been sort of sold to us by the car industry. And up until that point, streets were open, shared spaces where lots of different things happened. So one of the stories I tell in the book is, you know, attempts to try and turn the clock back. And we see this in some cities, notably in the Nordic countries. So places like Oslo and Helsinki, they have started reclaiming space, city street space, and giving it to cycle lanes and pedestrians and making things into parks and having, you know, less of an emphasis on a car centric approach. And we saw a lot of this last year with the first lockdowns as well, that in many cities space was, you know, taken away from cars and given over to other uses. So I think that's given us a glimpse of the way things were before the car and the way things might be again, where we do have some cars in some areas, but we don't sort of let them totally rule the roads in the way that we do now.
Now, Tom, you do address issues of infrastructure necessary that are stationary, that are not in motion, just to accommodate something like the automobile. You tackle things like jaywalking and signage along the way. You even get to talking about McDonald's and car culture and teenage car culture. We're going to have to bypass some of that. I just want a final comment from you. I'm really curious to know if, as the automobile came into our lives, was there really an original debate as to whether internal combustion was going to be preferred to, and say, an electric type of a system?
Yeah, there very much was. If you look at the 1890s, you've got steam cars versus electric cars versus internal combustion engine cars. And they're all selling in roughly equal volumes in the US in the late 1890s, about sort of 1,500 units a year each. And some years, the steam cars are selling the most. In 1897, the best-selling car in the US was an electric car. So it wasn't really until the early 20th century that gasoline-powered cars emerge as the winner. And it's because they've got this advantage that electric cars are still fighting to compete on, which is a gasoline-powered car really gives you this sense of freedom that you can head off into the unknown and you can find petrol out there somewhere and you can fill up your car and then you can keep going. And when you head out into the wild unknown in an electric car, you're always worrying about where you're going to plug it in next. And this was a problem back then. The batteries are much better in electric cars now, and they can go a lot further. And I say this as the owner of a plug-in hybrid electric car myself. The reason I bought a plug-in hybrid and not a full electric car is that the charging infrastructure in this country and in most of the world is simply not there yet for an electric car to be your primary car. The Tesla network is the best built out, so Tesla owners have the best of this. But for any other brand of car, you know, the likelihood that when you get to a charging station, it won't work, or it won't be compatible with your car, or it'll be full, or your app won't work with that particular network, you know, it's still a pain. So I think electric cars are, you know, becoming much more popular, and rightly so, and that's a very good thing. But funnily enough, electric cars were, there's been a sort of fall and rise of the electric car. They were taken very seriously at the dawn of the automobile age, and now I think they're being taken seriously again as we start to see our dependency on cars start to diminish.
It's a compelling read, a great book. It's titled A Brief History of Motion, From the Wheel to the Car to What Comes Next. Tom Standage, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much indeed.
The combustion engine combined with the wheel has changed our world, for better or worse, but bicycles are also still pervasive in every major city around the world. And they have reshaped our world, actually. We're about to pedal back in time to 1819 when the very first bicycle appeared in America. And it's a downhill coast from there. I'm Marcus Smith. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. You're listening to Constant Wonder. It's still 2019, so it's still a commemorative year as we memorialize the passing of Leonardo da Vinci 500 years ago. And now we want to call attention to another centennial, a bicentennial actually, because 200 years ago, the first precursor to the modern bicycle, something like a proto-bicycle of some kind or another, arrived in America. I'm going to guess it came by boat. Okay, the history of technology doesn't have to be all about America first, but this was the date 200 years ago when the first such creature came. And so early attempts to build a bicycle probably go back more than 200 years before 1819. You probably have to go to Europe, as I hinted. But you don't actually need to go all the way back to Leonardo, even though there was an apparent hoax going around, a drawing claimed to be a sketch of a bicycle by this famed inventor. That would have made the bicycle 500 years old. But it turned out the ink was a much more modern substance. So it was something of a forgery, actually. We're going to get to forgeries a little later this hour. Well, maybe Leonardo just did a leapfrog over the idea of a bicycle because he went straight to the flying machines. That was what interested him most. It wasn't just going fast on the ground. He wanted to get into the air. So he drew the flying machine. And there's a connection worth noting here because apparently the invention of the airplane owes quite a bit to the history of the bicycle having inspired the airplane because people were thinking about all those principles of how do you balance and how do you get a piece of metal that can fairly fly over the ground as fast as a horse, and as long as you're doing that, why not get up, up, up into the air? Well, on Constant Wonder now, we're going to visit the history of the bicycle in all of its bicentennial glory, if you want to go with 1819 as an important date. although I don't know of many anniversaries of any importance tied to like the the customs office. When you get to America, I've got a bike with me. What's it? What is that thing? It's a bike. We'll just take it in. Just take it in, and we'll write it down. And it turns out to be a mechanical horse that they put in the customs house entry. It's a very big subject because the bicycle was, if you pardon the pun, revolutionary. Margaret Gurov is author of The Mechanical Horse, How the Bicycle Reshaped American Life, and it's a pleasure to have her with us on our program today. Margaret Gurov, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you so much for joining with us. I'm going to start in the middle of your story because there's a confounded image in my mind that just won't go away. Whenever I think about the history of the bicycle, I think of this weird giant front wheel and this little itty-bitty back wheel. I think it was called a penny farthing?
Yes. That was a great technological leap that happened in the 1870s. It was called a penny farthing to kind of make fun of it. The people who rode them at the time called them high wheelers or ordinary bicycles.
Yeah, that's kind of in the middle of this story, and it just seems to me so utterly impractical. Have you ever tried one?
I have. They're really hard to ride, but they're incredibly fast because that big front driving wheel, every time you crank the pedals one time, it goes a lot farther than if the wheel were a normal bike wheel that we're used to today.
It's kind of like being stuck in high gear all the time.
Exactly, exactly. And that was considered a racing machine at the time. That's why they made those wheels so big, because they wanted to go faster.
Well, where do you like the story to really begin when it comes to the history of the bicycle? We're not going to be able to cover it all, but a few highlights would be good. Who, if it wasn't Leonardo da Vinci, does somebody get credit?
Yes, there was a guy named Baron von Drais in Germany, and he's the one who created what they called it's called in English a walking machine or a draisine, which looks a lot like a bicycle in shape, two wheels that are the same size. What it didn't have was pedals. So he put this together, and that's the thing that emerged in the United States in 1819. These were people in America were building these based on drawings that had come over from Europe. And it was very heavy, made of iron and or wood, and you would straddle it and then kind of push off on the ground. There's a new fashion for teaching little kids how to ride a bike by putting them on these little glider bikes, which are like little two-wheelers push along with their feet, right? Well, this is basically a gigantic, heavy iron version of that. They were very expensive. You had to be really strong to ride them.
I'm guessing it was good for downhill travel.
Exactly. I bet you would find a lot of them at the bottom of the hill. they were for people with country estates. But these were, even though they to us would seem very heavy and ungainly, at the time they were the first thing that could go as fast as a horse on land. You know, you could have a carriage, but that would go exactly as fast as a horse could pull it. And these, if you were going downhill, could actually go faster. So it was an amazing new experience for the people who were able to find them and ride them.
So basically this draisine had a couple of wheels and then something connecting the wheels with a seat, and it was heavy, and I'm guessing it was not a comfortable ride.
Well, it was fun. You know, it wasn't something that you would be able to go on a long trip on. It was very bumpy and very rigid. And you would, again, like we said, you know, if you got to the bottom of the hill, you would have to push it up the hill, which could be pretty heavy.
By the time you get to the penny farthing, it has spokes. And I think this draisine probably didn't have those wire spokes.
Correct. The draisine had wagon wheels, basically, because they didn't know. Those spokes that you're talking about were a special kind of tension wires that allowed them to make those gigantic wheels pulling with the staying round because of the tension of those spokes.
If it were made out of wagon wheels and were that large, it'd be very heavy indeed. I don't even know how you'd stay up. Well, I want to get into the use of a functional a bicycle that kind of resembles what we have today. What did you call that thing that had pedals plus the chain?
Oh, so that's called a safety. Those come along right after the Civil War, and that's something that you could. I'm conflating two. So the ones that came right after the Civil War had the pedals, and they were low, and then they got big to go fast, and then the designers figured out how to put chains on them to create spokes and gears, and they were able to create that same amount of force as if it had a big wheel by turning the wheel several times for every time the pedals turned. That's what the chains and the gears were for. Those are called safeties, and they came along at the end of the 1880s. And at that point, the bicycle became something that was available to anyone to ride, not just a very strong person who was wearing pants, so it would mostly be a man who could get up on one of those big, huge safety, big, huge ordinary bicycles, the big wheelers.
There's some famous statement, now that you've mentioned men versus women on bicycles, something Susan B. Anthony had to say. She was an advocate for the bicycle because?
Because it gave women a kind of freedom of movement that they had never had before. So before there were bicycles, people who didn't have a horse and carriage could only get as far as they could walk, or they could take a streetcar somewhere once those were developed towards the end of the 19th century. But women, particularly, proper women who were of a certain social class, were expected to stay very close to home or only to go out with permission of their husband or their father. And once this bicycle came along, it became possible for women to go out under their own steam without needing to ask permission or borrow the carriage. And so Susan B. Anthony felt that it was something that had given women a vision of what it was like to be empowered and what it was like to, create their own destiny.
There are such curious chapters in this story, and you cover so many of them in your book. You talk at some point about resistance to the bicycle for a host of different reasons. What were the reasons? What were some of the reasons that people would have said, let's not pursue this? This is a problem, this bike thing.
Right. Well, I mean, what you had mentioned about women was a big part of it. There was it threatened the social order in that way. Women became able to go out by themselves, meet together, talk about shouldn't we have the vote, So it had that aspect. Also, it was considered a social equalizer. So when the first bicycles came, in those big wheelers that we've been talking about, again, those were very expensive. So those were for people of means and people who were strong, so young businessmen. And they developed a culture of kind of hail fellow, well met. Like if you saw somebody else on a bicycle, you would know that they were of a certain social class and they were okay to talk to. But once the safety bicycle comes along and people of all social classes and races have access to this, then there's this kind of fear that, these social classes are going to mix and people are going to marry people. My daughter might meet and marry someone that I don't approve of. So there was that challenge and that fear. And in addition, there was concern about the health effects of the bicycle, because people, apart from people who had to have physical jobs, people who were either farmers, worked in factories, and those are people who often worked way too hard for their bodies and tired out very young. But people who did not have to do that kind of physical labor had the other health issue, which is that they were very idle. They didn't go very far. They, particularly women, again, who had to wear constraining clothes because of what was expected of them, very tight corsets and very, very heavy skirts, which could a middle-class woman's get-up could weigh 25 pounds. There was this common belief that exercise was not good for you, that it would wear you out, and that the more activity you did, basically the sooner your life force would be expended, and then you would die. And so that was a concern. You know, there were doctors saying, oh, you shouldn't ride the bicycle, you shouldn't ride it hard enough to, if you ride so hard that you get out of breath, then, you know, you're basically asking to die. And what people found, what people experienced when they started riding these bicycles for themselves was that actually exercise made them feel better. It made them feel stronger. And so all of these warnings from the medical establishment that it would, I mean, literally that riding a bicycle would cause heart disease, it would cause Graves' disease, it would cause, you know, epilepsy. People started experiencing what exercise really does for you, and they realized, well, these warnings are not correct. So the bicycle itself kind of responded to some of these concerns that people had.
You mentioned Graves' disease, and one of the symptoms of Graves' disease is where the eyes take on a different appearance, where you can see more of the whites. There's such a funny image of where one of these doctors is trying to demonstrate what can go wrong with your eyes. The idea was that in order to keep your balance and go fast, you'd have to open your eyes wide, and they'd get kind of stuck.
Yes, the dreaded bicycle face. So this was a medical concern that people, after they rode the bicycle, because it was so hard to balance, and it was so worrisome to ride around this way, so fast, right, all by yourself, that your face would basically get stuck the way, you know, with this worried expression on it, and that it would never, that they said, well, we can tell if you've ever ridden a bicycle because your face will clearly have this sort of distorted look.
You know, it seems so ludicrous now, and yet these ideas about health. I actually knew somebody who was an elderly individual who was of the opinion that we had a finite number of breaths that we could take in life, and that you should breathe slowly and infrequently so that you would just stretch your life out. And so I can kind of see how this might happen. Do you suppose, though, that the social revolution going on here might have been behind some of these claims about, you know, damaged health?
Yes. I mean, there was clearly no medical evidence for a lot of this. So it was you know, the doctors were concerned about trying to keep control of, you know, what people did. A doctor at that point, you know, this was at the beginning of modern medical science. You know, they were just discovering that germs cause disease. They were just figuring out a lot of the things that go on with the body. And part of a doctor's role at that time was not only as a health consultant, but as a moral consultant. So doctors expected to be able to tell you not just what was good for your body, but what was good for your spirit. And they felt threatened by this device that was going against what they were saying.
Well, good for the body, good for the spirit. The naysayers who are going to contest that. There were also people who were very worried about children. I'd love to hear you tell us about why kids should have stayed off bicycles.
Well, a lot of them were for the same reasons that they, you know, it was bad for their physical development. And also at the time when these medical warnings were coming out, there weren't really many bicycles that were made for children. It was still, you know, a very elite adult pursuit. So I wrote in my book a little bit about this group of performing children in the circus who rode these high-wheeled bikes. Of course, they were little because they were little children, but the New York Society for the Prevention of Child Abuse, I'm not sure I'm getting that name exactly right, they actually swore out a warrant for the arrest of P.T. Barnum, who had these children riding these high-wheel bicycles in his show because he was endangering them.
One of the things that I find just fascinating is the idea that I want to go back to the gendered business of whether or not women should have been on bicycles and who was saying they could or couldn't, and women's views themselves, Susan B. Anthony, all of this. At some point, there was a notion that a woman could go on a bicycle without chaperonage. That seems counterintuitive to the times.
Well, it was, and there were people that were arguing against it. This was a time when a proper girl couldn't go on a date without a chaperone, even to a place that was public. Like if you went to on a date to a restaurant, your aunt should come along for it to be proper. But there was an exclusion to that rule, which was you were allowed to ride horses. It was proper because, again, you know, you'd have to be a rich person to ride a horse. So if you were going on a horse ride with somebody, the presumption was that that person was of the same elite social class and that that made it okay. And what happened practically with bicycles was that there were moralists saying, well, you know, if a young woman goes out on a bicycle with a young man, there should be a chaperone. But practically, the chaperone would be a much older lady, usually, and not necessarily somebody who would be able to keep up on a bicycle. So it was possible to go on a date with a chaperone and end up without the chaperone. So that's the practical part. But then, you know, the societal part was that there was already this exception for horses, and the bicycle was seen as, you know, a poor man's horse, or what would could be a replacement to the horse, or the mechanical horse, the name of my book. And so they, the morals just kind of developed that even though it was still necessary for a chaperone to go along with you if you went, you know, to a restaurant or to the fair, if you went on a bike ride, it was okay to go without a chaperone.
Well, I want to just go with lightning speed now forward, as you may or may not have answers for us about where we're headed with bicycles. I know that The Mechanical Horse, your book, How the Bicycle Reshaped American Life, I really think the bicycle is still shaping American life and will change it in ways to come as we go forward. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, I have thoughts. They're probably, you know, no more valid than anyone else's thoughts. I can tell you what is going on with in cities right now with bicycles is that there are these two kind of countervailing forces. So there are people advocating for protected bike lanes, places where it's safe for cyclists of all ages to ride. You can look at some European cities, and you know, in the Netherlands, for example, and see places where the bicycle is just, you know, very prevalent, and it keeps the city quiet, it keeps the air clean, it keeps people in good health, and there are there are people in the United States advocating for this. On the other hand, we're a very car-centric culture. There are a lot of places where you really can't conduct your life right now without a car, especially if you have a family and you need to get multiple people to the same place at the same time. And so there's a political pressure to, as soon as a bicycle lane is added, there's political pressure to remove it, and so that's happening. And then at the same time, we've got in the cities not only things like Uber and Lyft, but the prospect of autonomous vehicles coming. And so there would be, you know, cars driving around with no driver, whether those would be kind of like a taxi or whether they would be private cars. And so the question then becomes, are those going to be devices that accommodate pedestrians and bicycles in the road? Are they going to be, you know, blend in with slower traffic? Or are they going to be programmed and regulated in such a way that the roads become too dangerous for bicycles to share with them? And, you know, it may go different ways in different places.
Sure, sure. You know, we're out of time, but I have one last thought, and I just want you to just react to it very briefly. If reshaping American life, if the bicycle had such an impact that the relations, the social status, the privileges between the sexes, male and female, if that revolutionized in some part what people wanted to happen in society or didn't want to happen, that's kind of a democratization. And I'm wondering if bicycles today also have sort of this egalitarian spirit about them.
They do. They can. I mean, there is a whole range. So there are lots and lots of people who use the bicycle for very utilitarian purposes, for getting to work, for delivering things. There are also people who want to spend thousands and thousands of dollars on them and go out, you know, racing on the weekends. So it's something that's accessible to everybody and is still a way, as it was towards the very beginning, a way of meet crossing paths with people that you wouldn't have otherwise. And there's nothing more democratic than that.
The book is The Mechanical Horse, How the Bicycle Reshaped American Life. Margaret Gurov is the author. Margaret Gurov, a pleasure to visit with you on Constant Wonder.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure for me too.
Farmed salmon is cheap and plentiful, but it comes with a cost. When salmon farms first came to British Columbia, marine biologist Alexandra Morton thought it might be a good move, but then came sea lice in swarms.
The Norwegians told me if the little fish have more than one louse per gram of their body weight, they're not going to come home. They're going to die. And so I told everybody, look, this is Norwegian research, but if you apply it to what I've seen, 97% of these fish are not going to come back. Yeah, 99% did not come back to the seven rivers of this archipelago, whereas on the rest of the coast, they were doing fine. And this touched off alarm bells. This is before everybody got into their little trenches and started to fight this problem in the media. But the government decided they would do a test and they would close the farms. And oh my gosh, so there were no lice and the survival of that generation of fish was just astronomical. A DFO scientist wrote a paper about it. He wrote a paper on how these salmon had survived so amazingly well among the salmon farms. He completely left out the part about the fact that those farms had been taken out off of their migration route. And the journal sent this paper to me for review because I had by then published several papers on sea lice. I was an expert on sea lice in North America. I said, no, you can't publish this paper unless he talks about the fallow route that was created to allow these fish to go to sea with no lice. And this man denied it and denied it and denied it. This is a very senior DFO scientist. And finally, the journal said to me, look, you're going to have to reveal who you are, because the scientific process of review is always anonymous and it allows scientists to speak freely without fear of ramifications. And so I did. And as soon as I revealed myself, he said, Oh, yeah, there was a fallow in the spring, but I was talking about the fall. No, he wasn't, because juvenile salmon aren't going to sea in the fall. And so the journal corrected it and the paper got published.
Alexandra Morton there, I like her already. She seems to me to be a fiercely independent scholar. And get this, she's also a woman who raised two children in life vests strapped onto inflatable motorboats. Why? Well, she's an orca scientist. And then became a salmon hound, and then became a leading expert on the topic of sea lice. And it all pertains to salmon farming. We're going to be talking about it with Alexandra Morton tomorrow here on Constant Wonder. You could call it a wild salmon versus farmed salmon. Well, a cage match, or a net match at any rate. And you'll find out who won. That's tomorrow here on the show. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.